Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren, sitting at the controls, and the other side of the country, we've got the great and only David Rose Martino.
you still got the rose thing in there, right?
Well, people tend to like that, so let's just stick with Rosie. I would call you Marty, but nobody likes that.
So. Marty,
that's very
Marty from Boston.
Yeah, see, that's what I mean. I was just thinking, that would work, but
yeah,
nobody likes it.
So. They don't like it.
No, people are mean.
They are horrible.
They turn into something awful. It's not Marty when it's finished. It becomes something really bad. So we can't say that on air anyway. But so now today, I think it's the first author that we've got from Pegasus. No, actually, it would be the second because John Copenhaver is one from Pegasus.
Oh.
I don't know if you knew that, but he's
from a
different division, but he's written for them as well, and his second book is through them. So,
excellent.
Kind of a coincidence, but this is our first non-John.
Non-John.
So, who have we got sitting on the line all the way from Scotland in his home, ready to have his haggis and talk about his new book? We've got Robert J. Harris. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, Robert J. Harris is my authorial name, but people just call me Bob normally. So special guy.
Yeah, well, I don't want to be too personal there right away. but now your book is A Study in Crimson, Sherlock Holmes, 1942. So very interesting take on Sherlock Holmes. What got you into writing this book? Like, why did you go into doing a crime book and with Sherlock Holmes?
Well, it's a bit of a departure. I mean, I start off, my first books I wrote were teen novels that I wrote with my friend Jane Yolen some years back. In my solo career, I wrote a couple of teen historical adventure stories. Then I was writing, middle grade novels. I did a series of comic fantasies set here in St. Andrews. And then followed that with the next idea I had was to write, some stories about the young Arthur Conan Doyle. It says schoolboy days, his early teens. And the idea would be, there's only one of them originally I worked out. So I wrote a novel about, young Leonardo da Vinci, one about young old Shakespeare. So the Conan Doyle is going to be a third in this kind of series of young legends. And so being Conan Doyle, I thought, well, I'll have an adventure in Victorian Edinburgh, which will sort of lay the groundwork for the inspiration for Sherlock Holmes in later years. But my publisher at that point, they looked at this and said, actually, it'd be a great series if you write more than just the one, which gave me a set of freedom. So I've written three of those called the Arthur Conan Doyle mystery, in which the young Arthur Conan Doyle and Victorian Edinburgh has to solve the mysteries of grave robbing and sabotage and magician back. And in the third book, there's a mysterious invisible thief who's robbing jewels around the town. And in the course of writing these, of course, it crossed my mind. I was trying to make mysteries worthy of Sherlock Holmes, to make this, get the atmosphere of the story. And that made me think, of course, about maybe writing a Sherlock Holmes novel. The problem with that is there are actually an awful lot of Sherlock Holmes pastiches out there. I barely read a fraction of them. Once I started looking on my Kindle, I realized there are people who've written like 20, and most of them are, you know, trying to recreate kind of Victorian adventure with greater or lesser success. And then there's spin-off things with Moriarty and Lestrade and stuff like that. And so I thought, well, if I wrote another Sherlock Holmes novel, nobody would care. We'd get no attention. And then one day, my eye lighted upon my box DVD set of the Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes films. The first two, which are set in Victorian times, Fox Pictures made those, The Hound of the Baskervilles and then The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. Then they dropped the whole thing. They weren't interested in keeping going. I guess they figured there weren't enough good stories available to keep it going. And Universal Pictures stepped in and they said, well, we'd like to take this up. And they made a deal with the Doyle estate. He died in 1930, so the stories are all under copyright because his family still owned the rights to all this. They couldn't make films of them without actually making a deal with them. And they agreed with Universal's idea to kind of refresh the whole thing by updating it to the 1940s for various reasons. One of which, of course, is this, like, you know, during the war, and Sherlock Holmes was a great champion for beleaguered Great Britain at that time. And so that Rathbone and Bruce, Michael Bruce and Dr. Watson, who played one of his first two Victorian films, also were starring in a very popular radio series as Holmes and Watson, set in Victorian times, were very well established. So now, when they actually made the first of these films, Sherlock Holmes and the Voice of Terror, the transition seemed very, very smooth. I mean, watching them again years later, before any thought came to make a novel out of them, I was always struck how easily they just moved into 1940s. Suddenly, you know, you've got airplanes and cars, but still Sherlock Holmes, still, you know, Baker Street looks much the same. So I was thinking about this, and the idea came to me, well, nobody's ever thought to take that version of Sherlock Holmes. It's very well established. There were 12 of the Universal Pictures series, and, you know, they're always on television, and I grew up on them, and other people did. I thought, well, no one's ever thought to write a novel taking this version of Sherlock Holmes. So I thought, that could work really well, because you've got the template there. You've only got these films, which really do remain loyal to Conan Doyle while updating the thing for the 40s. You've got the great wartime background. And I thought, well, yeah, that could work. That'd be where I write a Sherlock Holmes novel. It's something a bit different. We'd just be trying to redo old versions of Sherlock Holmes. It would be actually something that would be new because this had never been done in a novel before. And so I printed up the basic idea, the picture of Rathbone and Bruce and a title and just a basic blurb for the idea of it. And went to my agent, and my editor in Edinburgh, who had already published my two Richard Hannay books. So I'm going to be talking an awful lot and things. I've written two period adventure novels set in the early part of the last century, reviving John Buchan's the hero from the 39th text, Richard Hannay. And they were very happy with those I'd done. So when I sent them with this idea for Sherlock Holmes, my editor just said to me, do this next and do three of them. So they were quite enthused with just the basic idea. It took a few weeks more before the idea came of the plot of it. Once I got that, though, it really took off and all seemed to fit together really well. So that's as briefly as I can do it, how I came to write the book.
Don't you feel a great amount of pressure writing about a classic like Sherlock Holmes? Like, don't you feel like there's going to be people that automatically don't like what you do because of it and others that love it and all that? You know, isn't there a great amount of pressure just in the character itself?
Well, I've kind of done that thing with the not-so-famous Richard Hannay from John Buchan's novels. He wrote five novels about Richard Hannay. And I carried the adventure on into the Second World War. Not to get too much length about that. And the great majority got great reviews. And people who love Buchan's books wrote to me, and I met them in person, and they said how great it is to have these characters back again. But there's always a few dissenting voices. Someone might say, well, this is like sacred stuff. You shouldn't touch this. And that people are entitled to that. So I had a notion that maybe people would not take the World War II Sherlock Holmes. I want to be very clear on the cover of books with my book, Erica. So I've got to be on the cover. I've got to say it's inspired by the 1940 film series. But I don't want anybody to think, who is this guy? Somebody thinks he can stick Sherlock Holmes in World War II. Well, with the ludicrous idea, I want to make it clear that I didn't come up with this, but I thought it'd be a great gag or a great thing for me. So, and I feel that version of Holmes is quite well established. So, pressure, well, there's a pressure in it, yeah, but that just makes you work hard to get it right. So I was already been rereading the Conan Doyle story for my middle grade series, the Conan Doyle mystery. So I was carrying on reading those. So I was getting a really good feel for Dr. Watson's narrative voice and what the characters were like. And so in the course of writing this, I was rereading again and also watching the films. And I think those films do a great job of transposing Holmes and Watson into the 1940s. And so I think I'd absorbed all that. And I found that it was actually really, really enjoyable to do, to get into that setting and get into those characters. Yes, it's hard work, but it was very pleasurable work. I would read a chapter back and think, that's really come off well. That really reads like a proper Sherlock Holmes story. You know, they've got telephones and they're flying in an RAF plane and stuff like that. It all works out really well. Part of the thing with the book was, because I was aware that it's a bit of a transition, people who wouldn't be familiar with the film, and would think, what is this? This is really strange. You shouldn't have Sherlock Holmes in this period. So the first three chapters of the book are actually kind of a short story. It's a locked room mystery in the Scottish castle where Sherlock Holmes is flown up there to investigate the disappearance of the scientist inside a locked room. I thought, we'll have this little kind of classic kind of mystery first, and that will bring Holmes and Watson to the forefront, reintroduce them to the readers. So they'll feel familiar. They'll feel, yeah, this is Holmes and Watson. This is where we get into more unusual story. And so by the time they come back to London and have to take on these killings, like the readers were not already familiar with that setting of Sherlock Holmes, would have kind of segued into it. They'd have a sense of comfort with the characters in this new thing, and it would go well. So the reaction I've had, the reviews and feedback from readers, seems to be a great success, which I'm really happy about. Because what I want to do is for people to really love reading the books and enjoy them and get a great sense of joy out of them, which I get from watching the films and Conan Doyle.
Well, Crimson Jack. Now, who is Crimson Jack, and how do you come up with a character like that?
Well, I had a throwaway plot that I put on the blurb, the presentation in America. But then I was leafing through a book called The World of Sherlock Holmes, which is one of those Sherlockian books where you pretend that Sherlock Holmes was real and you sort of discuss what his life would have been like and what he encountered. And I got to a chapter on Jack the Ripper. Now, Jack the Ripper and Sherlock Holmes have faced each other a few times in Victorian times, in novels and in films. And I suddenly thought, oh, I had this idea of a 1942 story set in the same year as the Universal series began. And I suddenly thought, well, supposing somebody is murdering women on the same dates as Jack the Ripper, and he leaves a signature behind as Crimson Jack, then Crimson Jack came to me very quickly. This is a very natural variant on Jack the Ripper. The weird thing was that after that, I spent a couple of hours trying to think of a title for the book. And then when I thought, going back to the original title of the book, the first Sherlock Holmes novel is A Study in Scarlet. And because I had Crimson Jack, it seemed to just obviously fall into place. So I can't say too much about Crimson Jack, because the identity of Crimson Jack is the central mystery of the whole book, of who he is and why he's committing these murders. Having one of the great things having a kind of Ripper-style murders was, even though we're in London in 1942, it's got that Victorian vibe. This is a kind of a new version of the most famous killer of Victorian London. And instead of having the Victorian fog, we have the blackout because of the German bombing. London blacked out, obviously, that and the lights shining anywhere. So obviously, it was a great hotbed for crime at the time. So this killer is shrouded in darkness of the blackout rather than in the fog. The two things seem to come together really, really well. And so you've got, in a sense, that kind of creepy, gothic feel of Jack the Ripper. At the same time, you've got the war raging and all the blackout and other aspects of wartime London.
So how much time does that take to research a time like that? So, you know, you're covering it during the war, and because you have to make sure everything in the story is correct to time. Does that take a lot of your time?
Well, there's two aspects to that. One was that I'd already written this novel, The 31 Kings, which is a Canny novel set in 1940, which is, so I'd written a wartime novel. I'd also done a screenplay based on somebody else's novel set during the war. So I'd done a couple of things. I researched that period already because of that. And watching the films, of course, could do that. That was a source for how Sherlock Holmes functions in that. And obviously, I've got a very good friend. Her name's Kirsty Nicol, and she always insists I mention her. But it's quite right, too, because she has genealogy. She's got a degree in art history. She's very interested in all sorts of minutiae. And she's accessed all sorts of online resources. So if I'm having trouble getting some information about something, I will just email her. And within an hour, she'll dot it. You know, I'll say, what sort of meal would they be having at this time of day? And she would know everything they could have under rations and all things they couldn't have. Things that would take me a long time to find out. And I've got to go on about the book. Also, other things about my other aspects of the book were I wanted to have Sherlock Holmes, what would he play on the violin in 1942? Well, I've got a good friend, Dr. Toby Lipman, who is a retired doctor and a violinist, a very good violinist. So he actually gave me medical advice when I had questions about that. And also, when I wanted to talk about music, he gave me a lot of good information for Sherlock Holmes and that. So basically, it's you do as much research as you can yourself. But if you know people who can help you out, that's always great. They know things that you don't. And so the book was read over by my friend Kirsty to check it for any possible problems or flaws. You do that with most of my books now. And if she points out something that's half a little unhistorical, I have to think, well, does it need to be that way to make the story work? I mean, if you're bending things a little bit to make up the story, I think that's permissible, as long as you know you're doing it. So, there's certain things that I've had for books to write, but I thought the amount of research involved would be crippling. I would simply couldn't do it. So, of course, you find out interesting things. I mean, there was a point in the book where there was a typewritten note that Holmes had analysed. And so I went into that to discover that, in fact, you can, in fact, work out exactly the kind of typewriter that was used. And if anything, no, there are, in fact, the whole studies in this and systems of doing it. And this led me to the name of Ordway Hilton, who'd been doing this for the Chicago Police Department, their science department. And he was the document specialist. So Holmes quote him and he's using Ordway Hilton's method to analyze this type note they've got. And so finding out all about this, how this all works, how you analyze these things, was interesting. And I found that out by myself and put that in. It's part of the enjoyment of doing something. But you do just want to make sure you've not made a big mistake. So I do have a fact checker who goes through it for me. And I have some good editors too, my publishers, who will pick up things if I've got something wrong, which hasn't been too much so far. It's something I'm aware of, but it doesn't feel burdensome. It's a matter of making it an authenticity. Without beating people to death with your research, don't spend pages describing wartime London or exactly how things were. That kind of, there's a story to be told, and bringing in the things that are relevant to the story is what's important.
I was wondering how you keep track of your storylines and your characters. Do you have tools, a process, any methods for doing that?
I do a list of all the characters and type up what I know about them and what, and because some of them are like Sherlock Holmes and Watson are. Not my creations, but the thing with this particular version of Sherlock Holmes, of course, is that Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson in this story can't be exactly the same as Victorian Holmes and Watson. The original Sherlock Holmes is at the end of his career on the brink, on the edge of World War I. His last adventure, his final bow, takes place just before the outbreak of the First World War, when he's probably about 60. Now, in my story, Dean Watson in the late 40s, early 50s, in 1942, so this meant they were young men in the First World War. So I had to construct a different timeline for them. But they had to be the same people. They had to end up being the Conan Doyle characters, but by a different route. It's like if I'm in Scotland and I want to take a train from Edinburgh to Aberdeen, I can either go via Dundee or I can go via Perth. So it's different routes, but when you get to the end, you're still in Aberdeen. So this is the idea of this was to follow, to create the new timeline for these characters, but have them end up being the same men, and perhaps have a deeper explanation of why they like that. There are background to both of them that comes in this story. And of course, it's a heavy responsibility to keep them authentically Holmes and Watson while set in a different time period and with some different life experiences. But at the same time, it gives you certain freedom to explore it. So one of the things I did with that was to take elements of the actors, Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce. I made the characters in the book the same age as the actors were. And they both served in the First World War. Basil Rathbone was the captain of a scouts unit, the Liverpool Scottish. And his autobiography begins with a very harrowing adventure running across no man's land being shot at by the Germans. Nigel Bruce was shot in both legs in Belgium by German machine gun fire. And he was honorably discharged with injuries, but he joined the army again and became an officer in a training camp. So these guys weren't just some sort of wet actors who've never done any proper work in their life. These were men who stared death in the face. And so I took some of that and put into the So my Holmes and Watson also served in the First World War in very different ways. And Watson was wounded the same way Nigel Bruce was. So the constructing of that timeline was that was something I had to map out. There are various versions of the original Sherlock Holmes timeline that Sherlock had done. So I took that and then I did my paralleling one of my own timeline, starting much later. And I had to write that up. Then there was having a timeline of the events in the war, so not from the war time. Then there was I had a calendar of the days of the mystery. You know, you have to have that because the dates of the murders are very important. I have that and what's happening between and where it all ends up. So there are various timetables and background notes on the characters. I just keep track of it. I don't do any software thing, but I just type up a lot of stuff and. But once you've written something down, it tends to stick in your mind. But I would check something occasionally. And I always have a list of all the characters in the book that I add to it. I add characters to the book and make little notes about them.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I don't just keep it all in my head all the time. I mean, I'm not clever enough for that. But I have lots of notes on my computer that I can check up on to make sure I'm keeping things consistent and that it all makes sense, that, you know, something that should take 3 days doesn't happen in the space of an hour.
Well, do you have a subtext? Do you have a meaning? Do you have something that you hope people get from the book other than the story itself?
I think writing these kind of period adventures, like with Richard Haney's book and this book and its sequel that I finished recently, there are, against the background of war, a lot of things are magnified. You know, questions of honour and justice. So there's a great theme of justice in this book. Holmes talks about justice and the novel split into three parts. The first part's called deduction, the second part's called investigation, and the third part is called justice. So there are certain, I suppose, philosophical questions regarding the nature of justice that run through it. But that is kind of a subtext. And I would think by the end of the book, we just might be looking at it and have a few thoughts about that. You know, in a sense, you don't want to hammer on too much about stuff. I think the great thing that I think the sense of what these men have been through and experiences during wartime. Dr. Watson also, we go into his read for the death of his wife some years earlier. You know, Watson is widowed in Conan Doyle's stories, but not very much is made of that. So I make a bit more of that in this book. I have Watson reflect about a moving the death of his wife. So there's kind of thematics and there's kind of emotional resonances to it that I hope people will take away from it and really enjoy getting an emotional sense from the characters. Later in the book, Sherlock Holmes is sort of sent to Watson, one of his experiences in the Great War, in the First World War, that to a large extent it's molded his career made him the man he is. And I think that's a strong story and very moving. And so I think those are the things at the end of all people will have. It's not just a romp, it's not just a lark and a bit of fun. There's actually a lot of depth to it emotionally and thematically. By the end of it, we'll stay with people as well as the happy glow of having enjoyed a really, really exciting, intriguing story.
I read that you're a fencer, and I'm just wondering if you've ever had the opportunity to use that in any of your novels or short fiction.
Yeah. I haven't done it for a while because my knee's gone, but probably because of the fencing. But yeah, I do mention in this book that Holmes is on the Cambridge fencing team at university. So, where Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes is an expert boxer, which is one of the interesting aspects of him as a character, that he's actually very athletic. I kind of thought a later version of Holmes, making him a skilled fencer would be good. So I have recently completed all the editing on the second of my Sherlock Holmes novels, which is The Devil's Blaze, Sherlock Holmes, 1943, which brings in Professor Moriarty and Colonel Sebastian Moran, Moriarty's henchman. And there is, in fact, in the first part of the book, a pretty exciting fencing match between Sherlock Holmes and Colonel Sebastian Moran. And my wife is the first editor of my book. She's the first person to read the book and edits them ruthlessly and cruelly and tells me anything that's just not good enough and makes me work harder to make them really good. And when she read that bit, she said, "That's really good. You can tell you have fenced because you know how it all works." And this is it's supposedly a sporting thing with the two of them. I mean, the swords have got, you know, covers on them so you can't stab somebody with it. But I having fenced, some rather wild fencing matches, even with some guarded blades, you can get pretty seriously bruised, doing those. A friend and I were fencing, we were actually warned for a fencing match to tone it down, we were being too vicious. So you can do a pretty violent fencing match, even when it's not to the death. So I'm very pleased that came out and I got the chance to use some of that knowledge in the story and to present Holmes as a really good fencer. So I did get to use that. And I think also because Basil Rathbone was actually an expert fencer. He was twice an army fencing champion. And recently we were watching The Mark of Zorro, where he fences Tyrone Power and Rathbone is the villain. It's one of the greatest fencing matches in any film ever. And but they can do that because Rathbone himself is so good at it. And he fences Robin Hood and other things as well. So that it was partly a tribute to that man to give Sherlock Holmes a scale and have him demonstrate it in an extended fencing match in the second book of my Sherlock Holmes adventures. I enjoyed that tremendously, being able to do that and then use that experience. So yes, that did come into play. One of my more physical talents, so I don't have that many practical talents, but that was one that came into play. Yes.
I was going to say, with your wife being the editor, you probably have to fence.
Well, she fenced briefly, not as long as I did. She's a writer before me. That inspired me to get into writing. She's a fantasy adventure. She's got a whole series of books with Catherine Cup together. And then she was teaching creative writing and had her own private editing business. So that her editing me is sometimes a tense experience. It can be quite tense sometimes. If we disagree over something, you know, that I say, well, no, it's fine the way it is. No, you have to change it. But what it means is it gives me a confidence, right? When I finish the book at home and send off my publisher, I know it's in really good shape. Anything out back from publisher, there's never any major things wrong with the book. There's only little things they want to polish or things like that a little bit. So that's nice to have to know when the book goes out, it's in really good shape. It's been worth all the suffering. And our marriage holds together very well. I mean, we're still, you know, it's our 40th anniversary next year. So I think ultimately it strengthened it, the fact we do work together on things. When she was writing, I kind of pitched in here and there, helping out with bits of that, not the editing. And so we've worked together on these things over the years, and I think it's been good for us to do that. And it gives me, I say, great confidence that I'm writing. If there's something I've missed, something that I've maybe not hit the right note on, she'll read it and spot it and tell me what to do. And also she does quite a bit of research as well. She will research things while I'm writing, knowing what's coming up in the story. So I've got a kind of a researching team, which is a fantastic benefit to have. Not everybody's got that. And so having this support network of family and friends is great. And the editing I get from my publisher over here from Berlin, Polygon Books, is very, very good. Sometimes spotting things, I thought, gosh, I didn't spot that at all. That's not quite correct. So it's kind of a team effort, although, you know, I am writing this. I did a hard work after writing it, which is time consuming. I'll have my name on the cover of the book because I think I deserve that.
So your characters, where do you get all your characters from in the story? Like the outside characters, are they people you know, people you've seen somewhere? Where does that come from?
I don't really base them on people I know mostly. Obviously, the hard core of characters in this book, there's Holmes, Watson, Mrs. Hudson, Inspector Lestrade, Mycroft Holmes, come up, and Wiggins from the Regulars, who's now a young man and a fire warden in London. But all the other characters, of course, invented by me for the story. One of the most important is Gail Preston, who's an NBC radio reporter in London at the time. She becomes very much part of the whole investigation. And she's inspired by Helen Hyatt, who was a real radio reporter at this time. She reported a radio broadcast from where the war was in London and on the continent. And she wrote a book about it, her experiences. She inspired that. I was looking for a strong female character, and I thought, well, yeah, an American woman in London working for NBC, that's good. And she has a very pivotal role to play in the story. Part of the fun of the thing is, when I was writing the book, was I was imagining it as a film made in the 1940s and casting as many people as I could in all the various roles. Obviously, because I've got Rathbone and Bruce and Miss Hudson and Dennis Hoey's version of Inspector Lestrade are all coming from the film. But I kind of, at the game, was just casting everybody as well along. So I cast Alice Faye in the role of Gail Preston, who is not as famous as she should be now, but she had a fantastic career in musicals and drama in Hollywood. But then in the 40s, she retired. She married Harris, which is already married, well, Phil Harris, a band comedian, and gave up this whole career to raise their family, raise their daughters. Which a mark of Trent's character. I mean, they were together until death. They also had a family. Seeing her in films, Gail is played by Alice Faye. And Eric Bloor, who played a lot of comic roles in 30s and 40s films, the part for him in it. And all the way through it, he's able to find somebody for all the parts. then come up with a character. I don't know, this spring into mind. It's like, there's not really a method for creating characters. Have a somewhat slimy reporter. Which I feel unfair about it. I feel most work on slimy this guy is. And a repugnant artist turned up in it as well. And that was fun to write. I guess it's writing characters who aren't very nice are actually much more fun to write. And of course, when you're writing a mystery like this, it's a matter of there should be lots of characters in it because they're the suspects. You know, which one of them is the murderer and why are they doing it? So you do need to get characters who are interesting in themselves and have their own kind of story to carry on. And so they seem to just pop it into my head and then and go from there. But this has a bonus of, and we put it online at some point. I do have an entire cast list for the whole film, every part that's being played in it. And it's an actor, an actress, every one of them. Just because it's fun to imagine it actually being a 1940s black and white film. I think that's all I can say about the
characters. Well, I'm wondering, too, with your characters, when you create your characters, do you have an inner monologue in your head? Can you hear your characters? I know I hear voices. that's the joke, but how does that work for you?
Oh, no, but, yeah, well, I don't know if you guys have got a writer here, yeah. I think my strength as an author are plotting and dialogue. And I think the characters come out mainly in the dialogue, the way they speak, the things they say. And so, you know, Holmes and Watson, of course, have a very sort of high diction. They're highly educated men and still kind of old-fashioned, even though they're not Victorian gentlemen. They've been to public schools and they have that kind of thing. Whereas, say, Inspector Lestrade, he's not much of a character in Conan Doyle, but Dennis Hoey's Lestrade. He's not a common man character, and I really enjoyed writing for him, giving him a kind of almost Cockney richness to his expression. He's got lovely tons of phrase that are things that Holmes and Watson wouldn't say. And so his character comes up very much in that, and then his attitude of being not really a plodding policeman, but actually a good, but a hard-working staff at the job. And then with having, a character of Gale, a method character in the that she of course talks in a way totally different from anybody else in the book. She has a kind of slangy American way of talking. It was also really fun to write, especially when it's a kind of 40s thing there. And I find that as well as a slight physical description, I think the dialogue about the characters, the things they say, you know, will really bring out another nice touch to these things written in this period is. And these days, everybody smokes. Hmm. And so people can, you know, there's pipes and cigars and cigarettes. And that, you know, and these are great props when characters are doing things. You know, you can probably light a cigarette in a certain way and stub it out decisively. And that makes a statement. Or they can blow smoke slowly while they're thinking. And there's all these things you can do with that as a prop. Which nowadays, people cut smoking in a story would be odd. It would be a thing that would be too much. Where then, it's a whole thing, Holmes and his pipes and all that, are all very much part of the whole new year. And once again, they're character expressive. You know, does somebody smoke cigarettes all the time? Do they have the occasional pipe and the thinking? That's it. They smoke big cigars. And so that's a period thing that allows you to give that aspect to the characters that you couldn't really do in the same way now.
Now, do you have a website or a place that people can find you or find out more about your books and stuff?
Yes. At the end of every one of my books, I have an author's afterword to explain a couple of things. At the very end, it has my website, which is www.harris-authors.com, all small case. And that has biographical information about me. It's got stuff about the book, got all my books listed, things about them, a few articles I've written in connection with the book. It's also got stuff about my games that I've made, and my wife's books are featured on there as well. So it's a treasure chest of fascinating information, which I'm still trying to add to. I've made up this cast list for the novel, and I need to get that actually online as well. It's friends that run the website for me. So I have no idea how to do it. So I just send them things, and then when they've got time, they'll put them up there. I really appreciate the work they do for that. That's it. You just go around and find me, Robert DeHart, and you'll find this on there. There's also links to a comedy podcast that I do with my friend Alan McFadden, which will give you material for now. It's called Quantum Fridge. It's a comedy podcast company. And we do, we have a fabulous cast and we do comedy shows, science fiction and mystery and adventure comedies that we do. Also, there's links to that too. So anybody plunging into the Harris website will find games, comedy, novels, and everything your heart can desire other than whiskey and cigars.
Oh, too bad. Well, we'll have that actually linked up to our site as well, so people listening can do one
click. That'd be great, yeah.
So that's easy. And
a nice thing too is because people can contact me through the website, and Tony and I go right to me and say, I want to have enjoyed a book. That take the time to do that. You don't get the direct experience of people enjoying the book because it's kind of different. I've been writing for our podcast thing about Al and I wrote a comedy which was recorded by the BBC many years ago, and it was a big live event. And they called a play, a pie and a pint, and we had a pint of beer and a Scotch pie. We were watching this comedy we put on about American and Scotch, and it was fantastic to have written something and be sitting there in an audience that was just enjoying the hell out of it. They were laughing and cheering and like recording indoor. And that's a great thing to hear. Also, because about my younger books, my books I've written for middle grade kids, I've done a lot of visits to schools and I get to put on plays with the kids and do story making adventures with them. And it's wonderful having them react. How much do they enjoy it? How enthusiastic they are about all this stuff. And so I think when you're sitting at home by yourself writing a novel for grown-ups you send out there, you don't get that kind of thing. So people do write. I really appreciate that when you get in touch and they want to enjoy the book and ask them more. Luckily, as I've mentioned, people have asked me, are you going to do any more of these? Yes, it's all done. It's going to be coming out. Well, it's coming out over here next year, and I'm hopefully Pegasus will be very keen to do it again. Another one, because it seems to go down very well over in the States, getting great reviews in major publications and getting publicity. People like you are taking interest in it, which is great. Because the worst thing for any author is to put all the heart and all the talent into a book, and then it just disappears. Nobody even knows about it. It's not nothing to do with it's good, bad, or indifferent. People don't read it because they don't hear about it. So you want attention for the book. So I'm really glad that the concept of doing a 1942 Sherlock Holmes based on this film has intrigued enough people that it's actually getting quite a bit of attention. And that means people will hear about it and give it a try. And I hope they'll all enjoy it. They'll enjoy it tremendously. That's what I want more than anything else. People will read it, have a fantastic time reading it. We'll just be completely absorbed in it. And get to the end of it all, they'll feel really satisfied. And be gasping for more, because there is more.
Wow. There you go. Well, we appreciate it. How was writing during the pandemic for you? Did it affect you at all?
Not much different. Because you're just in the cold. We were lucky. Last summer, we've got a nice garden. We live in a nice neighborhood. We've got a dog, so we can take dogs for walks on the beach and everything. With stuff like this, keeping in touch online with people is really great. You have to contact family and friends on Skype. We have weekly meetings with family. Particularly with my son, who works in publishing too. He and I would meet on a Skype session with a few beers. We called it Man Skype. Oh. So we're able to still, have the kind of chat we normally have, and another friend of mine, he joined in with it too. And it was just great to kind of sit around and do the kind of talking you do with your friends and your family. It was nearly as good as actually being there, and it meant we didn't lose that. So, because you didn't have contact with people. Earlier this year, we put together a bunch of writers online to celebrate the friend Gene Owens' birthday. We got about 10 writers online together on a Zoom thing. And it's just really nice to stay in touch with other writers as well and see what they are doing. For what we work at home like this, I know some people, this has been a terrible time for them, what they've had to go through. They're stuck in an apartment block with four kids who can't go to school. All this, it must be really, really tough. So it's been easy for us, but our kids are all growing up. Some writers I've seen online saying, I can't concentrate. No, it didn't really affect me. It's been pretty soft for me. I appreciate how easy this has been for me compared to how some people who've got difficult jobs to do and, have lived after. So it didn't really impinge, although, writing about World War II, it's not the same thing, but life is restricted then by rationing and blackouts and things. And the restrictions we've got now, comparatively slight, really. But I'm hoping that it'll all be over soon.
And we'll do
some traveling.
Well, it's been a great show. Thank you for coming on. Our book today that we're talking about is A Study in Crimson, Sherlock Holmes, 1942. And the author was our guest, Robert J. Harris. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for mentioning it in the book. I hope that the listeners will go and try it out and really enjoy it. And be back for the next one.
I'm sure they will.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll tell you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.